Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Empowerment, social justice, compassion, the hallmarks of Anastasia Higginbotham's personal and professional life. Her 20-year career as a speechwriter for New York City nonprofits that combat injustice paved the way for her work as a writer, illustrator, and creator of the children's book series Ordinary Terrible Things. It tells the stories of youngsters who navigate trouble with, quote, their senses sharp and souls intact. Help may come from family, counselors, teachers, and dreams, but it's the children who find their own way. Book number one, Divorce is the Worst, published in 2015 by the Feminist Press, was followed this year by Death is Stupid. Up next, Tell Me About Sex, Grandma. Actually, Anastasia has made books by hand her whole life with whatever she could get her hands on. She uses only recycled materials, including items from family treasures like rosary beads, old dish towels. Anastasia's essays have appeared in Glamour, The Sun, The Women's Review of Books, and in the anthologies Listen Up, 33 Things Every Girl Should Know About Women's History, and Yes Means Yes. Anastasia, welcome and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Even though I said you've made books by hand your whole life, Divorce is the Worst is your debut picture book.
Yes.
What propelled you to leave speechwriting and move into storytelling?
Well, the speechwriting continues. I support myself still with the speechwriting primarily and writing for nonprofits. And it was in addition to, it was something that I needed to do and had been for a long time trying to create. I've been trying to make my artwork and my writing come together for years and years and years. And it finally came together with this series. So I have been writing about my parents' divorce and the effects of various other things in my childhood and that I witnessed.
You made this series, in a sense, very personal.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It comes from a very personal place, even though, you know, I create a fictional character and I have them go through a crisis in a way that is relatable and has a very embracing quality to it, so mm-hmm. that a child who didn't have my exact story, there's enough space on the page and enough space in the story for a child to really project into there and say, you know, that looks a little bit like what I'm going through, mm-hmm. or that looks enough like what I'm going through that I can imagine this story is about me.
You're still writing speeches, but this is something that was more in your soul, in a sense, mm-hmm. that you had to talk about, right? Mm-hmm. You couldn't put a lid on it. It was bigger than you.
It wouldn't rest. I couldn't let it alone. It wouldn't let me alone. It's not as satisfying to me to write essays. Mm-hmm. And I do still write essays. And it's difficult to find the right places for things that I've written. But it's when I put the images, because I've always drawn pictures and made little pictures to go with things personally.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So for my friends, for my sisters. It was adding the pictures, adding the images that finally let me start to talk about what I really want to talk about, which is the ordinary terrible things that happen in your childhood are, you bring them right into your adulthood.
No kidding. Well, they
really
are who you are. They make you who
yes.
you are.
Yes.
Not that you're necessarily, one is not necessarily defined by divorce, mm-hmm. but so impacted by it.
Yes.
Talk about how you were impacted. Were you a youngster when your parents split?
I was old enough that I think it was assumed that I would, that, you know, the kids were old enough. Mm-hmm. My youngest sister was 10. I was 14. Mm-hmm. And then my brother was 16 and my two older sisters were already at college.
You're from a big family.
Yes. So all five of us got this news and I was very identified with our family as we were the five A's, all named with
the letter A?
Yes. Uh-huh. The letter A. And my mother made clothes for us often that matched. All five of us.
Wow.
So not, you know, not just twins or something. All five children, matching outfits, matching names, and very cohesive family in my experience growing up. So we had lots of cousins and aunts and uncles. And
This was your world.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And my parents were strict about sticking with something. If you're taking ballet, you don't quit ballet.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in the band, you don't quit. And so I had this idea of who they were and who they always would be and who we were and who would always be with these seven people. And then when the divorce was discussed with us.
Did you have any clue that they were unhappy?
I knew that they were unhappy because each of them had experienced the death of the same-sex parent in like the last year or two.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I had seen my mother go through the death of her mother. Mm-hmm. I had seen my father go through the death of his father. So any tension in the house and sadness in the house, I attributed to, well, of course. These two traumatic events. And also they were working really, really hard. Money had been difficult for several years. So my mother who had been at home and taking care of us and taking us to all our lessons and taking us to school and doing all of those things that mothers do in that role, she had to go and work, and she was working for my father. So it was stressful. And they weren't home in the evening when we came home from school, the three younger ones of us. And so all the stress and tension that I thought could easily be attributed to too much work and some grief. And maybe that exacerbated and made it so that they needed to get a divorce. But they got to this point of like, oh, no, we're getting a divorce. And it took me very much by surprise.
Wow. And especially when they were preaching one thing and not practicing it, that must have been so confusing to you.
It was confusing to me that they would give it up. And I took it very personally. And I took it on very much like, you know how sometimes children will feel like they need to choose a side?
Yes.
Between them. But what I realized, actually, I realized it while I was making this book, Divorce is the Worst. The side I chose was theirs in the sense that, well, they were clearly hurting and they were clearly suffering a loss. And their heartbreak of not being able to live their lives out together like they planned to, I took that on. And so I didn't have good boundaries about like, well, wait, what am I feeling about this? Because I felt like my mother, or I felt like my father. So I felt bad for my father that he had to go. I felt bad for my mother that her thing didn't work out the way she thought it would. And I was kind of lost.
I can hear that. So in a way, you had to navigate this by yourself.
Well, I guess so. I mean, people weren't unsupportive, but it was very like...
But it was maybe not relatable.
No.
That they could understand what you were going through is what I mean, where you just feel very alone.
Nobody died. So that's what I thought in my head was, well, nobody died, so
right.
I should just be grateful. This could be a lot worse. You know, this is not such bad news. You know, and that was the message that was being told to me. This is for the best, and of course it makes sense, and it's going to all work out, and, you know, you wouldn't want us to stay together if we don't want to be together.
Sure.
It's like, of course, of course, of course. But it was, there was no room for me to feel how I felt at all, which was just, they took the family away from
us. So you just had to soldier on.
Yeah. I mean, I knew their marriage was irretrievably broken. I knew I didn't want them to get back together because I could see like, oh, yeah.
What's the point?
This is, they need to be apart. But the soldiering on was more like, it's just like I had the fracture of them just in my body.
Got it.
So it was doing things to me. Like I was fully functioning in the world and I didn't even, you know, I wasn't really experiencing any depression or anything at that point, but I just, it affected everything. It like warped me. I was like, okay, marriage doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was making,
generalizations. Yes, right.
Marriage doesn't work. People don't stay true to their vows.
Mm-hmm.
They lie or they say it and it doesn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm. You really, in a sense, catastrophized it.
All the kids did. But the five of us, we all dealt with it in different ways. But my way was I really like internalized it and carried it around.
But until you had that light go off, I have to share this in a different way.
Yeah.
Was it liberating for you?
It was very healing for me.
Oh, that's a better word.
Yeah. To put those images down on that book. And before that, I had been trying to process it, and I would tell the story. You know, I would just write out I kept coming back to that same moment of, you know, where I was standing at the kitchen counter drinking a glass of milk when my mom told me, I've asked your father to leave. And it's just, it was a place that I kept having to return to in my writing and a place I kept having to return to in my relationships. I kept finding myself at that same place. So it wasn't until I wrote Divorce is the Worst, the script, and then over the next several years, tried to figure out how I was going to illustrate this. Was I going to do it like comic book style? And then when I got the grocery bag style, and I took myself out of it, but I put my heart into it. And then I had these pages and these images that were very validating. Looking right, I was making the validation that I needed. I was walking myself through the process.
So it's interesting because what you did, you used brown bags to illustrate. What you did was extremely personal and necessary for you, but is out there for me to read and other people to read. So you provided a public service in addition to taking care of yourself. Mm-hmm. We're jumping around a little bit, but you get into speech writing and you work with nonprofits, correct? Mm-hmm. So you always had a tendency or a draw to social injustice and the downtrodden.
Who's not getting listened to? Who's not being heard? Who's not getting a fair chance? I was always keeping score as a kid. My mom would say, stop keeping score, you know, and I do.
You felt you needed to speak on other people.
Make everything fair.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I could really sense and see, and I think a lot of kids are this way, and maybe it gets trained out of us or something, but like it, I took it to a kind of a crazy level where like when I put the dishes away, I would make sure that the dishes that just came out of the dishwasher went to the bottom of the pile so the ones that had been waiting got their turn.
Oh my gosh, I do.
You know, I mean, people do that. Yeah.
Okay, phew.
That's how I mean.
Yeah, okay.
But that's the level at which I interact with the world, you know, in terms of fairness and making sure people get a chance.
And get their fair share.
So that, you know, that always resonated with me. But in college is when I was really, you know, I took women's studies and I took black studies. And that, you know, that put me on a course toward activism. It's a kind of activism where I could support myself by working for nonprofits that do work that I believe in. And then here I was using my writing to, you know, affect social change and pay the bills, which is exactly what I needed to do.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Anastasia Higginbotham, who is a speechwriter and also an author. I just have to say parenthetically that when I saw your name, I thought you should be a governess. With a name like Anastasia Higginbotham, you should be a governess. So you put your thoughts down on paper, and out comes Divorce is the Worst. You didn't contact a social worker. You didn't talk to a therapist. You knew what you knew because you were there.
Yeah. Divorce is the Worst poured out. I mean, I worked on it and perfected it and polished it for a long time, but it came right out. Death is Stupid, too. Just boom. Right out. I mean, the words. It takes a long time to make those images. But that was in me. And then I went to people who I trusted and said, does this resonate for you? But while I was making it, I didn't have a publisher. I didn't have an agent. I wasn't on a track where I thought necessarily this was going to work out.
Because you had a full-time job.
Yes.
You were doing this on the side.
And I was having children at the same time. So I
you mean you were a mom?
I have two children now. And so they were... My eldest was in his infancy when I first started this. And then, you know, 4 years later, I had another one. So all while these books were getting born, children were getting born, too. So I was taking care of them.
So interestingly, you're married?
Yes, you, reluctantly. I love my partner. He's wonderful. But I cannot call him
your husband. Wow, that's really interesting.
It freaks me out.
But you did marry him.
I did marry him. Mm-hmm. And he is... I couldn't possibly do better. We have a really the perfect relationship for us. But just in terms of having a bee in my bonnet about marriage, that was really it just rankles.
But did it surprise you that you got married?
No, I had to. We had to. We were going to stay unmarried. We were 10 years into our relationship.
Well, I guess I am asking you about having a relationship. I didn't know if you would swear that off.
I have always sought out relationships. Mm-hmm. I'm often... I've had a lot of good, very connected relationships, but none as good and connected as this one.
So you're a happily married woman who's learned a lot from what you've experienced in your past.
Mm-hmm. And what I experienced through my friends and what they're going through as well.
So you knew after Divorce is the Worst that you were going to tackle death? Mm-hmm. Why?
I wanted to hit the big ones. I wanted to hit all the big things that are the most, you know, the very common childhood things that when they happen, because they're so common, our families and our culture tend to expect, oh, the children will get over it. They'll get over it. Children are resilient.
Yes.
Kids
yes.
bounce back. Look
right.
at them. They're playing already. And I am determined to draw attention to the fact that children have very, very intense inner lives, and that just because they're not talking about it with you doesn't mean it's not happening. And they're making sense of things, and they're noticing the contradictions, and they're aware of when they're being lied to. That's a perspective on how, I mean, there's like a children's rights aspect to this,
mm-hmm.
which is just about the fact that, look, you don't know what's going on in their heads. And we don't get to know. They have a right to the privacy of whatever they're experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
But I like taking the hardest things and that I can think of that are ordinary, that are especially ordinary. There's a lot of hard things that are, you know, extraordinary. But, you know, death, divorce, confusion and conflicting messages about sex.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I could go on and on. But the stress in children's lives is real. The conflict mm-hmm. that they are working out is real. And they need a different kind of support. They need some validation and understanding about it instead of just expecting them to just...
bounce back?
Yeah, what is that bounce back? You know, Linda Barry, a cartoonist who's a big influence on me, she calls resilience a belief that adults have about the inner lives of children, that they don't, just because they don't remember, doesn't mean it means it didn't affect them. But I'm not quoting her exactly right, but it's the ability to exist in pieces is what she calls, you know, what adults believe means that children are resilient.
I think what you've done, too, is that to tell it like it is, but with no sugarcoating. It's
yes.
not that you're beating anybody over the head, but boy,
no.
this is no walk in the park, and this is no picnic. And I was particularly struck in Divorce is the Worst when you focus in on bringing in mom and dad's new friend.
Yeah.
That's a big one, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a big one, and it gets... I feel like I wanted the kid to be alarmed. I mean, I wanted the kid to be running from the friend as if they're running from gunfire, you know, like in a zigzag.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And because here's this person who's all of a sudden in the inner circle.
Yes, yes.
How'd you get here?
Yes, in the first tier.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
All of a sudden now, so I see my dad twice a week, and now I got to see him.
Good old what's her name?
With... And it's kind of, you know, it's scary to see your parents date and think about them being rejected, too.
You worried about them being rejected?
Well, yeah. Like, does he like her? Is he good enough? You know, like those kinds of questions. You know.
Wow, that's so interesting. I don't know that I would have necessarily thought to go there.
It was a little maybe over enmeshed.
So the strategies that you provide in your books came from?
My own coping strategies.
Your own coping strategies.
Humor.
Yes.
Yes. What is actually happening? What is really happening? Like, how can we clear away all the garbage? And what is the truth of the matter without the sugarcoating, without the spin? Because then you can deal with it. I mean, an adult or a child, it's all that spin and all those euphemistic discomfort.
Right, cliches.
It's comfort.
And yes.
I don't want comfort. Tell me what's happening. What's happening? And then let me just feel how I feel about it. And then trust me, I'll be all right. But like... First, you got to just let
you
me
mean,
have the reaction.
Tell me the truth, but not with all the details. Dad and I really love you, and we love each other, but we can't sort of make it work together is just sort of not enough.
Yeah. I think divorce is the worst for the parents in a lot of instances. And both parents may not have chosen it, but they might be saying, like, you know, they have to put up a brave front.
But the point about divorce, which is so fascinating, is it's ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And so is death. You die. I mean, that's the beginning and the end of that.
Yeah.
You'd like to think that someone is not going to get a divorce, but people who stay married are probably more in a minority. But, you know, so that's why your book is critical.
And I really want to please the social workers. I want the therapist to look at the book and say, thank you, I can use this. I can work with this. But I didn't go and read all the books first and then decide, you know, that I knew how to make mine.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Anastasia Higginbotham, who is a speechwriter as well as a writer, illustrator, and creator of the children's book series Ordinary Terrible Things. Talk about death is stupid. So you dealt with divorce. Now, you've experienced death because your grandparents died. Mm-hmm. Have you been spared as you made your way through childhood?
Mostly, yes. The first death I ever experienced was I was five, and a beautiful young aunt of mine took her own life. And so my little cousin's mom
died. Oh, wow.
And but I was five, and so my memory of that is that I got to wear my nicest clothes to the funeral, and I was happy about that. Like, a family funeral meant I get to dress up, and I'm going to see my cousins. Like, I didn't understand that death is a real thing, and that these children, their mother died, you know, and my uncle, and he has to make sense of this himself
for
and continue to be a parent of these very young children. So that was the first one. And then the next ones were grandparents. And those were just, they were very interesting losses because my mother told me, my grandmother had been dying for as long as I knew her. I think she had Alzheimer's.
So you knew no other way.
I knew no other way. And so I just thought she was just really sweet. But at the end, you know, it turned and it wasn't sweet anymore. Or maybe it never was sweet. But to me, the experience that I had of her was just such a delight and softness and sweetness. So, but when she died and my mother told me and I gasped, you know, she said the nursing home called. And she said, "No, honey, I've been praying for that woman to die, because her mother died, you know, was lost to her for years before she died.
Right.
So she had been grieving that death already, and I knew what she meant. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel like she was denying me my grief in that moment. And then when my grandfather died, my father's father, he didn't go to church with us, and he didn't believe what we believed. We were raised Catholic and we went to church every Sunday, and grandma his wife would come with us to church sometimes, and I knew she believed, but he didn't. And I thought he was going to go to hell, because I would go to church and I would listen, and I took everything literally, which is really actually had a lot to do with my social justice stuff. I mean, I was inspired to be radical from what I was hearing at church. What I was really hearing at church was about, you take care of people.
I see.
And if people are downtrodden, you take care of them. And if people are hungry, you feed them. And if you, I mean, that to me was just direct. It was going right in. It's like, you don't let people suffer, you help them. And also, if you don't believe, you're going to hell. I mean, if you don't do this and live this way, you're going to hell. So when my grandfather died and I knew he wasn't religious like the rest of us, I thought he was doomed.
His soul was doomed, yeah.
And that was, I really needed help with that. So, and that's important, you know, that's one of the things, reasons why I want this book, Death is Stupid, to be out there, so that whatever the inner questions and conflicts and fears that children are having gets somewhere in this book, gets mirrored or triggered, or, you know, they can be aware of what their actual questions are. So they can say to somebody, "Hey, is grandpa going to hell?" And somebody can say, you know, "No."
I understand that death is a very uncomfortable topic to share or to talk about, but the impact that it would have on a youngster who's trying to make sense of all of this, or she's watching you, what does that mean? Or, you know, it's just...
I mean, the kid in the book is when does she watch me?
I mean, Anastasia, you're saying the obvious on one hand, and on the other hand, it's like, duh, you know?
Good, it should be like, duh. It should.
I've been on the receiving end of comments like that because you're uncomfortable saying it to me.
Yes.
So that's, I guess, why cliches are cliches.
Well, and we get so scared about kids. We don't want to tell them the truth, but the lie is scarier. She's Only Sleeping is much scarier.
Yes.
Because, you know, I go to sleep every night.
Yeah. Am I going to wake up?
Sleep. If the child is trying to, like, figure out how to keep their parents from dying, too, and their siblings, and it's just like, oh, yeah, that's not useful. And if you go to the woman who told me to make sure I put that in there is a funeral director and a dear friend from childhood who said to me, I hear this every day. Every day someone tells a child that their loved one is sleeping. She said, and sometimes these kids are with us when we go to the cemetery and lower the
casket
into the ground. And what are they thinking about, whether that person who they love might wake up?
and be
underground.
Underground. Yeah.
Now that's a horror show.
You're damn straight.
So that is not doing anybody any favors.
We don't have a whole lot of time left, so I think I want to end a little bit upbeat in the sense, funky as your next book is. Tell me about sex, Grandma. I mean, I'm a grandma, and I'm hoping that question isn't asked of
really?
Me. Well, I don't know, but I mean, my grandchildren are very young. Yeah. But what now? Where's that come from?
That comes from when one of my children was six, and he made this like very kind of odd sex joke. He had just started school. He had just started like pre-K or I don't know what year, first grade. And he made this sex joke and I gave him kind of a look and I said, "Where'd that come from?" And he was like, "I don't know." And then he just turned and like looked me straight in the face and he said, "What is sex?" And the answers that came into my head were wrong. They were all wrong. Like I had the first answer that came was like, "Well, when a man and a woman," and I was like, "Nope, that's not the answer."
Mm-hmm.
When you love someone very much, and I was like, "Nope, that's not the answer either. It's in you already. Sex is in you already. You're born with it." And now there's much more to say about this that has nothing to do with the actual sex acts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
yes, that okay, that's a thing, but in terms of what a 6-year-old wants to know and a 7-year-old wants to know, an 8-year-old, when those questions are asked, I believe they're asking, what is the fuss about? What is it that makes your face do that when I
right.
say, when I make a sex joke?
Right, right.
And I'm just repeating what somebody said at school. And I think kids are just like with death and divorce. I mean, they can sense somebody's trying to hide something from me. So what is it? And if a child feels like something's being hidden from them, they're going to go looking for the answer. And where do you want your kids to go
Hello.
Looking for
mm-hmm.
answers about
mm-hmm.
sex? I prefer that they come to Grandma. I mean, she's been there, done that. I mean, come to somebody who you can trust to talk to you true and answer your questions. And I know not everybody's grandma's going to want to have that conversation with them, but I wanted to go to a family matriarch. I wanted to create a character who this child trusts. And in my idea, it's like the kid has asked about it at school and been told, don't talk about that here. The kid has asked about it from their own parents and been given a biology lesson. And that's different. That's not what they're asking about. They want to know about what's dangerous, what's bad about it. And
mm-hmm.
they go to the one place they know they can talk about what's dangerous, and that's Grandma.
Isn't that great? Oh, Anastasia, people will say to me, oh, thank you so much for the opportunity to have this conversation. I'm the one who should be saying these things. I mean,
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
No,
you have
this
such
was
energy for it.
This is all my pluses, really. I can't thank you enough for writing the books and sharing your stories. And
thanks.
Maybe we'll have you back.
I'd
after the grandma book comes out.
Okay, yeah, you have to tell me, what do you think of it?
Oh,
it's useful.
Absolutely, and I'm sure there are many more books because
yes.
God knows there's so many topics
yeah,
out there.
Yeah, I could go on and on.
I can't thank you enough. So I'm going to say thanks again.
Thank you, Sandy, so much.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women, and if you know a creative woman who you think we should interview, contact us at sandyclineshow.com.